Hi, good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the next installment of our monthly speaker series. This is John Patika Jr., company with my father and senior member of the team in the Patika Wealth Management Group here in sunny Clearwater, Florida. Our special guest today is Eric Potiker, and covered our healthcare as an analyst and a portfolio manager since 2002 here with UBS. And he's previously worked at a couple of different multi-billion dollar long short funds as their healthcare sector head. Also worked at a family office and portfolio manager. He's covered the healthcare sector broadly, including pharmaceuticals, biotech companies, as well as healthcare services and medical device companies. He uses deep fundamental research approach to stock picking and looks for attractive growth and value opportunities. Eric has some pretty great reports in the healthcare sector as far as stocks and companies he follows. So if anyone on this call wants to maybe send something out to them, just feel free to reach out. Eric's also received his BA from Dartmouth College, an MBA from University of Virginia, Darden School of Business. Welcome, Eric, to our call.
Hi, thanks, John. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and with your clients. Appreciate also that generous introduction. I think probably best to start with just our overall, as a chief investment office CIO's overall view of the healthcare sector that the strategy team puts together. And I contribute to that, but they really decide in terms of our overall sector recommendations. And we have healthcare most preferred. It was upgraded earlier in the year, and that's particularly when the framework of how the strategy team views the market broadly, which is to have some exposure to growth and some exposure to defensive sectors, of which healthcare is one, and really where the team, and I concur with them, views healthcare as probably the most attractive among these defensive sectors, particularly driven by what should be accelerating earnings growth this year. It's really got more growth than some of the other defensive sectors, and it's coming off a year where, frankly, it had declining earnings in 2023. So we see that recovery, and it's really driven by the post-pandemic dynamic. A lot of healthcare benefited in 21 and 22 from pandemic-related sales and earnings, COVID vaccines, COVID diagnostic tests, and a number of other dynamics, which started to unwind last year, and that caused healthcare earnings to decline last year. That process is sort of now bottomed, and we see healthcare earnings returning to a more traditional pace in 2024, accelerating through the year. And that's really why we have it as a most preferred sector.
What I'd like to focus on today is some of the major themes in healthcare. You and I talked yesterday on this. I thought there were some fascinating things, and I thought that in our limited time that we could focus on that, and then you can expand on it. And I think we ought to start with the obesity drugs. I mean, it's been a giant gainer in some of the stocks. So maybe you can comment on that and tell us how you see the future of the obesity theme.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, I think the obesity theme falls into the broader innovation theme within healthcare, and really, obesity has probably been the dominant topic that I've been asked about by clients and by advisors over the last, call it, 9 months. Really, most attention really goes to the drugs that I'm sure most of you have heard about, Ozempic and Wegovy, as well as Mounjaro and Zepbound, all of which are in a class called the GLP-1s. And that's not a new class. It's actually been around for a couple of decades. But those specific drugs, first approved for your diabetic use, and more recently for obesity treatment, are newer versions, and they are particularly effective at weight loss with what are shown to be pretty manageable side effects. And they've really, you know, they threaded the needle in terms of obesity and weight loss from a pharmaceutical therapeutic standpoint. Prior drugs either weren't that effective or had very onerous side effects, in some cases were pulled from the market. So we see with these drugs really having threaded the needle, now the opportunity to treat obesity patients effectively and safely. And as you can imagine, with the media coverage and really what is very strong demand into what can be a very large market, the two manufacturers of these drugs have seen significant appreciation in their stocks. And there are expectations that this may well be the largest drug class that the market has seen, potentially rivaling oncology as a broad class. And that sets up a lot of potential growth. And we generally concur with the market view that these will be very large products in what so far has been a relatively small obesity therapeutic market until these newer drugs have emerged. At the same time, you see a number of fairly significant rate limiting factors on the growth of these drugs into this market. First of all, they are very much supply constrained. The two manufacturers are racing to increase their production capacity, but they're not easy drugs to make. They're injections. They go inside of delivery mechanisms that are in many cases like pens. They require cold storage. So there's a complex supply chain, and there are very significant supply constraints that are really going to be around for the next few years. In addition, these drugs are expensive. And then given the potentially very large demand, given the obese population in the U.S. and more broadly in the entire world, these drugs will create, and their use will create, significant budgetary issues for payers. That means employers in the U.S. and government payers in the U.S. and globally. And, you know, I think that will limit the growth and create certain issues in terms of what patients are approved and reimbursed for use. And I don't think the market, in terms of how it's treating the specific stocks of companies that have these drugs, I don't think the market has fully taken into account some of these growth limitations. I also think some of the other issues that will emerge, too, are just how long patients are going to stay on these drugs. So far, the clinical data and the real-world use data suggests that in order to keep losing weight and then maintain weight loss, one has to stay on these drugs. So you could see patients regaining weight once they go off the drugs. There are side effects to these drugs. You know, they seem to be manageable for the most part, but they still are there. And you know, in the history of pharmaceutical use, people tend not to stay on their drugs perpetually. So that's another question just to think about, is how long will patients stay on these drugs? And one of the other issues we've seen is when these drugs, you know, have come to market, gotten a lot of attention, the manufacturers have also produced outcomes data showing that these drugs help with other health conditions, the most notable of which was a study that came out last summer and really drove a lot of media coverage and a lot of market cap appreciation for the two companies that have products in the market space. And that study showed a meaningful decline in cardiac risk, heart attacks, strokes, and cardiac-related death over a long period of time. And that really suggests that perhaps there are health benefits downstream that could reduce costs and improve health and partially cover some of the expenses related to actually taking these drugs. That also caused a lot of investors to worry about some of the existing therapeutic markets that are out there and whether the decline in obesity and the downstream health effects would in fact reduce the number of cardiac procedures, stents, bypasses, number of orthopedic procedures, hip and knee replacements, diabetic products and therapies, particularly for the type 2 diabetes market for the adult onset. We actually think that a lot of those fears are overdone, and that in fact these obesity therapies can exist in harmony and in some cases in a complementary manner with a number of the medical procedures and tools that go into providing conducting cardiac surgery, orthopedic surgery, and broadly the diabetes treatment market. So kind of the market overreacted to that late last year. And some of that is unwound a little bit. A lot of those companies have sort of regained some of the lost market cap that they experienced when that large cardiovascular outcome studies came out. So suffice it to say, we think these will be big drugs. We think there are going to be rate-limiting factors that perhaps the market is not fully appreciating today. And we don't think these drugs are really going to be massively disruptive to the existing ecosystem in healthcare, because we think, frankly, the obese population is so large. And in many cases, the other treatments for that population are still relatively underpenetrated. And that even if there's a reduction in the obese population, if we look out a decade, we don't think that's going to be enough to meaningfully slow the growth in some of these other markets. I guess I'll stop there in terms of the overall take on the obesity market and these therapies. But let me know if there are any follow-up questions on that. Pat can also talk about some of the other innovation that we see in the healthcare space.
Yeah, Aaron, that was great. You covered from A to Z. I appreciate it. And again, we have some detailed reports that you've written if we want to get more granular. But I want to move to dementia and Alzheimer's next as far as major themes. You know, talk about progress and the way you play it.
Yeah, there too is, again, a very large market, very little on the market in terms of available disease-modifying therapies despite a lot of R&D investment by the industry over the last few decades. What is encouraging, we've seen the approval actually of two, but really only one that is now being marketed, of a disease-modifying therapy. It was launched last year. And yeah, I'd say there's another one likely to be approved later this year. Neither has put up tremendous clinical evidence yet in terms of their ability to really significantly modify the progression of Alzheimer's dementia, but they do show encouraging signs, at least being able to slightly reduce the progression over time. The issue is, you know, this is a complicated disease. It's also a complicated therapy to administer. It requires significant diagnostic testing, and it really requires the infrastructure in terms of delivery of this kind of infused medicine and really extensive monitoring of patients. That infrastructure is sort of just being built out in the academic medical centers where most of these patients are being treated with these drugs. And it's just going to take time. I do think that despite what I think is modest efficacy and the complications of building the infrastructure to deliver these drugs, I do think over time they'll ramp and that they'll actually be quite large simply because of the unmet need. But I think that, you know, the need is still there for more effective therapies. And really, we don't see any evidence to date of anything that's really game-changing in terms of dementia. But I do think the emergence of even the existing disease-modifying drugs with modest efficacy, I think, is an encouraging sign. It will drive more investment into R&D by companies to find better solutions. And I think even incremental progress is better than what we had for the prior 20 years, which is nothing. So I'd say important slow ramps, and hopefully now at least the opportunity with additional investment to find even more effective treatments over the next decade.
Well, the older I get, the more I hope they hurry up.
I agree. Me too.
You know, maybe this will help. It's a natural segue. Let's talk about AI, artificial intelligence. Any thought on how this might help all of your...
There's been a lot of speculation, I think. So just to frame artificial intelligence as we see it within CIO, really, I mean, has been around for many years, and the pharmaceutical industry in particular has been using machine learning and sort of large data analysis to try to accelerate and improve their R&D process and basically improve both the time and the quality of the molecules coming out of their R&D efforts. And I think we haven't really seen any significant improvement. You know, the overall rate of new drugs approved by the FDA has gone up over the last decade, but not by a step function, I'd say, you know, incrementally, and it tends to jump around year by year. I think the emergence of generative AI, which is really what has had the market very excited about ChatGPT, has some potential to make, I think, on what we've seen initially from the commentary from the large pharmaceutical companies, I think it has the potential to make their R&D efforts more efficient, certainly has the ability to help them conduct clinical trials more effectively. If you think about where do drug molecules fail, a chunk of them fail before ever going into humans because either they seem to not work very early or they show up as being toxic when being studied in animals. But then a lot of them fail once in humans because of either toxicity or because of they're just simply not effective enough. So AI certainly has the ability to widen that funnel at the beginning and then narrow it more quickly so that molecules that are more likely to succeed can emerge in that narrow part of the funnel, but they still need to go through clinical trials. And I think the big impact of AI, I think, near term is going to be just the ability to run clinical trials more efficiently. And that means better selecting patients, being able to better make sure that patients stay in trials, that the communication between the companies administering a clinical trial, the key doctors running the trial, and the patients is more efficient. And those are important pieces. Again, not step functions in productivity or return on investment for R&D money, but I think incrementally driving a higher hit rate for those R&D dollars. I am skeptical that we're going to see a sea change or a quantum leap in the efficiency of R&D in the near term. And I also think if we do, I'm not sure the economic benefits will necessarily accrue to the pharmaceutical manufacturers. In the ideal world, if you're able to identify a drug and make it more personalized so that it goes to exactly the kind of patient who will benefit from that drug and doesn't go to patients who will not benefit from that drug, that's a huge step, a huge positive step for overall health. But the economics of that dynamic may not necessarily lead to greater revenues because there will be a lot of patients who today are being given drugs that may not benefit them that much, but that revenue still flows into the pharmaceutical company. So there will be a change in the dynamic of the revenue model if, in fact, AI is able to introduce a more personalized targeted medicine. So very early days, I'd say too early to predict. And I'd say none of the pharmaceutical companies that I follow are really being impacted by anything they're doing in AI. There are some smaller companies that, you know, have businesses where they analyze data and make that available to larger companies. They're relatively small, relatively volatile in terms of stock performance. So I think it's still early to invest, to see a significant or to expect to see a significant AI benefit for the healthcare industry more broadly, but I do think it'll drive efficiencies over time.
Eric, thanks. Biotechs. I know there's big bio and small biotech. Maybe you can touch on that. I still think there's a lot of juice left in there.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as part of that innovation theme, a lot of what we've seen really over the last four decades have been smaller companies funded by venture capital, usually in partnership with academia and or government, getting funded and eventually coming up with groundbreaking drugs that then emerge into companies that we all know and can identify that have been built through venture capital investment. What we've seen, I think, really leading up to 2021 and then particularly during 2020 and 2021 was a turbocharged bubble in biotech funding, where earlier and earlier stage biotech companies were basically getting public. It used to be you couldn't go public as a biotech unless you had proof of concept, which means data in humans in a controlled clinical trial that showed that your drug worked and had a reasonable safety efficacy balance. I'd say starting in the late 20 teens and certainly in 2020 and 2021, companies were going public before they even had data in animals. And so the pulling forward of much earlier stage, much less mature companies, much higher risk companies into the public markets, I think really was a bubble. And I think what we saw in 2022 and 2023 is that bubble bursting, in part because of interest rates, in part because of the sheer dynamics of having far too many very early stage public companies that investors simply couldn't analyze and simply didn't have the wherewithal to analyze. And so we're coming out of that bubble and really having had a biotech funding desert for the last 2 years that I think started to improve and show some signs of improvement late last year, but we're still not out of it. There's still, as I said, you know, dozens, if not hundreds, companies that frankly are too early to be publicly traded and are now burning cash and not able to fund themselves. So that dynamic in terms of consolidation still needs to play out in the public markets. The process has started. The higher quality companies are getting bought by big pharma and big biotech, as has been the case for the last three or four decades. Others are able to fund themselves in the public markets, but largely because they have shown data that is basically proof of concept. And the ones that don't have that data, that don't have proof of concept, continue to be cash starved and probably aren't going to exist for very long. So I think that normalization and equilibrium, I think we're moving in the right direction there, because ultimately we need venture capital and IPO funding for biotech. You know, these companies don't generate cash. They have to get external funding. And if you don't have a healthy venture capital or IPO market, which then obviously fuels the venture capital market, it's going to retard innovation. So, but again, I think we probably got out over our skis, you know, 5 years ago leading up to through 2021. So it's a healthy process that we're going through now. And look, I still think there's a lot of really good innovation taking place. It's just not easy to sift through all the companies that are out there and figure out who's got really promising innovation and who doesn't. And public markets are not necessarily the most efficient way to separate the wheat from the chaff in that regard.
I do have a few more questions, Eric. One would be COVID. We're on the other side of that bump now. And I'd like you to talk about it. And also, just for my own curiosity, not necessarily an investment theme, but what is the next COVID disaster? Are they prepared for it? Has that industry actually started to prepare for something?
Let me take your last question first. COVID came out of nowhere in terms of there wasn't much preparation. We hadn't seen a global pandemic of that scale for over 100 years. I think there's some awareness and some infrastructure in place that would help us better deal with the next global pandemic. But I don't know that we're going to be any more prepared for it. I mean, look at sort of spending, government spending in terms of health infrastructure. It hasn't really changed materially over the last few years. Governments are very good. Politicians are very good at forgetting some of the lessons that they just learned So I think if we do have another global pandemic, I'm not sure that we're going to necessarily have the infrastructure in place to react much better. But I do think there will have been lessons learned that should improve the reaction point. In terms of when it'll happen, I really don't have a clue. I hope it's at least the same time interval as the last one, but I'm not so sure that'll be the case. I mean, COVID, it really rippled through the healthcare system, caused a lot of massive revenues coming to the few companies that could quickly produce a vaccine, and the ability for companies to create an effective vaccine as quickly as they did, get it manufactured and get it out to people is really remarkable. And in that sense, I think going in the early phases of the pandemic, no one thought we'd be able to get a vaccine out by early 2021. I think people were thinking it would take at least another year or two based on prior vaccine timelines. Instead, what we saw was a massive marshaling of resources. Marshaling is probably the right word, in that it probably resembles the Marshall Plan in terms of scale and effectiveness to get vaccines out and to get an effective diagnostic testing apparatus in place. So those things, I think, really showed the ability of the healthcare industry to deal with, in a fairly rapid manner, deal with that kind of global pandemic. But they also created all kinds of distortions within healthcare markets from an investor standpoint. We're still working through trying to understand what the real underlying growth rate is for a large segment of healthcare companies that have really been whipsawed with massive growth during 2020 and 2021. And then that growth, in many cases, falling off a cliff as the incidence rates of COVID decline. As I said in the beginning, I think we're getting to the point where we can see the ex-COVID growth rates and financial profiles of the vast majority of healthcare companies without the noise of COVID. And I think that's overall healthy from a healthcare investment standpoint.
Mm-hmm. A couple more, Eric. We talked a little bit about regulation and price controls. There's a misunderstood thing with the price controls on the government 10 drugs. Maybe you can just enlighten us to what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. So the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, included provisions for Medicare, the federal program for elderly beneficiaries, to quote unquote negotiate the price of drugs for that population. It will amount to price setting, most likely, by Medicare. You mentioned the initial group of drugs, there'll be 10, and the prices will likely be set this fall. And that group of drugs will expand to 20, and then I think to 50 over the next 3 or 4 years. Now, the impact overall is going to be manageable because some of the guardrails that were put in place as that legislation worked its way through Congress largely protect the industry, in that you can't negotiate or price set price on a drug until it's been on the market for many years, until it nears its own natural exclusivity lapse, which is usually related to when the patent expires. So there's safe harbor for most drugs, probably not as long as the industry wants, but still they're relatively protected as they grow their franchises. Now, I think the fear is the government will do more over time, and I'm not so sure that'll be the case. It was quite hard to get the Medicare drug negotiation provisions through Congress. The pharma industry still has a lot of lobbying dollars and a lot of support. They barely got it through, and I'm not sure that anything like that would get through the current Congress or the likely next Congress we face. So while there's always talk, and I'm sure that certain politicians will want to do more in terms of price controls, I doubt we see anything more in the next few years, particularly in a closely divided Congress. And I do think the provisions that are in place are manageable for the industry. It's certainly much better than some of the other proposals, legislative proposals that were floated by members of the House and certain members of the Senate, and by the prior administration as well, which had a very aggressive policy towards drug pricing, at least rhetorically had an aggressive policy towards drug pricing.
Yeah, maybe in the future we'll get you back a little bit and talk about once the government camel gets his nose under the tent, we'll see how far he goes. But it will be interesting to see if these industries can raise capital if this thing gets out of hand. We'll see. As of now, it's not out of hand. Last thing I have, though, it's an election year. You hear all kind of sage advice. Don't get involved in healthcare during the election year. What say you?
Yeah, I think if you look at historically over the last 7-8 election cycles, you don't see a clear pattern of healthcare performance relative to the market during an election year. Nonetheless, I think investors have grown to be more wary of healthcare in an election year. I think this year, though, healthcare is going to be pretty far back in the list of topics discussed and debated by either party I mean, in part because, you know, we just talked about the IRA. That was a large, probably the largest single legislative accomplishment by the administration. The healthcare components of that, I think, are likely to be touted as achievements. And I think that makes it unlikely that the Biden administration will be pointing out all the things it didn't accomplish on healthcare and that it wasn't able to get through. So I don't think they're going to be as focused. You're not going to see talk about Medicare for all in this election. But we are hearing about Biden saying he wants to do more on drug pricing. Again, I think that's more rhetorical than anything else, because I just don't see how they'd be able to get anything more through. What will be, either way, will be a very closely divided Congress. So I don't think there's going to be as much pressure on healthcare as a campaign issue. I think where one could worry is the emergence of a bipartisan populist alliance of Republicans and Democrats that might decide it wanted to take on the pharma industry. Look, at the end of the day, cheaper drugs are very popular with just about everybody. Cheaper drugs are very popular with seniors who vote. And you could see in both parties some sort of, as I said, populist alliance. However, betting on bipartisanship in Congress has not been a winning strategy over the last couple of decades. So I wouldn't put high odds at that. But if that's the one thing I watch for, not so much going into this election, but coming out of it, is, you know, could you see some kind of alliance between the two parties and would have common ground and see mutual benefit on trying to do more on drug pricing? I'd say low odds, but not zero odds.
Thanks, Eric. This is John Jr. here. We're getting close to the end of our time here. And for anyone who wants Eric's reports, feel free to reach out to the team. We'd be happy to send it over to you. It gives his latest thoughts and companies that he follows. But before we end, Eric, wanted to see if you had any closing thoughts.
Yeah, I'll just share with you how we view the sector and the components. And, you know, we are most preferred on medical devices and life sciences tools. So yeah, those are sectors that generally don't have a lot of regulatory political exposure and have very sustainable long-term growth drivers. And we also have the health insurers, as most before, that's preferred. That's a little bit controversial and frankly hasn't been the best call year to date. But we think medical cost trend is going to slow down as we go through the year. And that will mean that they have some upside to both margins and earnings. And generally, those kinds of companies, health insurers, do well in a high interest rate environment because they benefit from the float. And we're more cautious, neutral on pharma broadly, just because we just discussed the IRA and the pricing dynamics. While we think those are manageable, I think there's still a sentiment impact that I think will limit valuations for that group. And we also see a number of large products that are going to lose exclusivity over the next few years, creating a growth question. So the pipelines really need to emerge for many of the large pharmaceutical companies outside of the ones that have obesity treatments. And that's why we're a little more neutral, or why we are neutral, not a little more, but why we are neutral on pharma and biotech. So I'll leave you guys with those broad subsector views. And if there are any questions, I'm available to speak with clients and happy to do so. It's what we at CIO are here to do.
Great. And you guys are great partners. So we really appreciate Eric. And for anyone who wanted to listen to a replay of this call, it'll be available in the next week or two on the Apple Podcast under the Pateka Wealth Management Group podcast channel. Feel free to subscribe on there and then you can immediately get alerted when podcasts come online. And so as we close here, I appreciate Eric. Thank you for your time. And for everyone on the call, you guys have a great rest of the week.
Well, thank you both for the opportunity.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.